Okay, it's from Luke 8, verse 40. Jesus heals a woman and Jairus' daughter. Now, when Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue. And falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house, for he had an only daughter, about 12 years of age, and she was dying. As Jesus went, the people pressed around him. And there was a woman who had had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, "Who was it that touched me?" When all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the crowd surround you and are pressing in on you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me." And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." While he was still speaking, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, "Do not fear, only believe and she will be well." And when he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter and John and James and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep, for she is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. And he directed that something should be given her to eat. And her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened.
So I'm sick and I'm feeling sorry for myself, and that's pretty much what I wanted to say from the beginning, so much so that I'm really glad that there's not a lot of people here tonight. So thank you to the people who's not here. Lorraine asked me last night whether I'm going to be ready for the sermon, and I said I'm at that point where I don't really care whether I'm ready for a sermon. So I'm a very bad sick person. In terms of really feeling sorry for myself, and then everything around me can just crumble, and I don't care, even if you guys are the victims of that. There's a quote from a book, a very famous book, and I want to see whom of you are readers over here. It says the following: "You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb inside his skin and walk around in it." From which book is that? Good. To kill a mock. Which edition? Okay. Yeah. To kill a mockingbird. Even if you do not read somewhere in your lifetime, if you went to school, you would have been forced to study To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's this wonderful scene from one of the great literary characters of all time, Atticus. So maybe you guys remember Atticus is the dad, and I know a lot of girls had a crush on a book character, Atticus. And then they made a movie, I think it was in 1967 or something like that. And I'm not going to tell you the story, but in this specific scenario, he's talking to his little girl, Scout. And it's not even about race in this specific context, but he tells her, just imagine living like that person. Just try and see it from their perspective for once in your life. And you can see Scout, the little girl, she gets it. And it's so wonderful because, as you guys are well aware, children have incredible imaginations. So that's why when you walk past a bunch of kids, they're always playing a game and none of them are playing themselves. You're always playing something else. And you have to repeat it twice. Then it becomes a game. So if it's doctor, doctor, or teacher, teacher, or more, more. That's how it works. These are just the rules. And there was no protest from Scout because she had the gift of imagination. You have to grow old to lose imagination. But as a child, you've got a very, very well-developed imagination. And she could get it. And I think, given our talks about race during this past week, that I'm wondering whether a lot of South Africa's issues wouldn't be solved if we have better imaginations. Because what happens when we imagine a little bit is we grow in our empathy for other people. Isn't that true? When you imagine yourself in somebody else's shoes, in somebody else's skin, then you get a little bit of perspective from their side, and you're not just defending yourself because you've transposed yourself and put yourself in their position. So I think if we can get a little bit more imagination, we won't only be able to solve more of our problems, whether it's just relationally or racially or whatever the case may be. I think we'll be able to understand Scripture better. I think one of our big problems with understanding Scripture is that we have horrible imaginations because we are told what to imagine because we don't read anymore. So what do? Disney and DreamWorks Pictures and Hollywood, they've got a monopoly on imagination. They tell us exactly what we need to imagine through a picture. So we do not do it on our own anymore. And that's why we've got really, really weak imaginations. And that's why a lot of people find the Bible incredibly boring, because it's written economically. In other words, the writers in those days didn't have paper, so they had to be very economical with their words. And so we read this, and we think it's boring, because we're not seeing it in Disney. We're not seeing the Disney castle. We're not using our imagination. And I think when we use our imagination, specifically with respect to this text that Lorraine just read us, you're going to see that this is such a dramatic story, and the empathy that you're going to get, or the realization of what emotion is going through their heads, is the one of desperation. They are incredibly desperate, both of these characters. Jairus, the leader of the synagogues, whose daughter is on her deathbed, 12-year-old daughter, and the other lady who's got internal bleeding for 12 years. These are two very desperate characters. Now, before I came here, I asked two of my housemates, what is the most desperate situation that they've ever been in? And it's actually not a bad exercise. I want to ask you guys, what is the most desperate you've ever been in? And it can be comical. It can be a relationship kind of thing where people say, you know, you're a little bit desperate and it's a little bit weird. Or it can be tragic. But if you think for a second, what is the most desperate you've ever been? So whilst you think about it, I'm going to share one comical one from my side at least. As I told you, I'm not very good at being sick. And when I was at university in my third year, I got very sick. Now that's very sick by my standards. Probably you guys would still go to work. But I couldn't eat for like days, and I couldn't sleep because I can't swallow. You guys know that throat thing. That's very annoying. And I eventually asked this one guy, I think my roommate just said I need to go because the whole place was smelling like death. So he took me to the doctor, and I'm in his consultation room, and I'm sitting over there, and he looks, he examines me, and he says, "You're really sick. You've got a good reason to be here." Now, remember, he said, "You've got good reason to be here," because I think most of the students that goes to him do not have good reasons to be there. They just want a certificate. So he says, "You've got really good reason to be here." And he writes me a prescription. And I look at the prescription, and I say, "No." And I put it next to me. And he says, "What do you mean?" I said, "I'm not moving." And he's a little bit flabbergasted. What do you mean you're not moving? I said, "I came here to be healed, to be cured, and I want to be cured. Now, I'm not going to go. I can't drink pills. I'm not going to take these pills. I want to be fixed now." And as a 21-year-old student, I cry. I cry in his office, in that consultation room. And I promise you, from his expression, and I think he's been practicing medicine for some time, he's never experienced that before. I was crying and I couldn't care less. And I think it was about 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And right there in his consultation room, they got me a little bed, they got me a drip, And that guy couldn't see any more patients for the rest of the day because I was lying in his consultation room. And I've got a drip, and they're feeding me the stuff through there. And the next day, I was happy. I think later that night, I had to go out of the consultation room because they've got a lockup or something. But the fact of the matter is, all my pride, or all my sense and sensibilities disappeared because I was just really, really sick. And I wasn't going to drink one more pill because I've already drank 500 pills. I wanted to walk away here feeling better, and I threw that burden on him. So whatever the most desperate situations, and I'm not saying that's my most desperate situation, but maybe that's my most comical desperate situation. But most of us are young people here in the Allure. But from what I gather, we do not know what desperation is until you've had a child. Now, maybe some of the parents here can confirm that, but apparently you do not know what desperation is until you've had a child. So what most parents would do, so my friends who's starting to get kids now would tell you that when that kid is born, it is the biggest moment of your life. And I mean, these are guys playing rugby. They're not lyrical about stuff. They don't, you know, give their wife roses every day. They're pretty much guys, and they say your whole worldview gets destroyed in a second when that child is born. And I've heard various descriptions, but it's so weird because you don't have control over your own heart, because your own heart is walking around. At first it's crawling around, then it's walking around, then it's driving around. That's what it means to have a kid. And if you have two kids, then your heart is split up, and they are going in various directions. And that is why when Jairus reacts the way he reacts, it's because he's a dad and his daughter is dying. Now remember, what makes this significant is the fact that this guy is the leader of the synagogue. Now the fact that he's the leader of the synagogue, first of all, means that he probably does not like Jesus that much. Because remember, Jesus is a troublemaker. Jesus is not in with the religious elite. He's not in with the social elite. In those days, the religious elite and the social elite meant the same thing. So Jesus is not Jairus' favorite guy. He is making political statements that is inappropriate. And at best, the leader of the synagogue, the president of the synagogue, needs to keep a safe distance from Jesus. So for that guy to not only come and approach Jesus, but to be on his knees and beg for help, that is very, very desperate. A very desperate situation from Jairus' perspective. Now, something horrible happens to poor Jairus. Because as he's taking Jesus, his last hope. Now remember, this was not Jairus' first attempt at saving his little daughter's life. For him to do that in front of Jesus was his last resort. So he's doing that, and now he's got this healer. He's a bit of a maverick. Word is going around that he's doing some cool stuff. He can heal a little bit. And he takes him to his house. But now Jesus has got a little bit of a gathering, so there's a lot of traffic around him. And as Jairus is so desperate and pulling him through, Jesus stops and says, "Somebody touched me." Now, at that moment, Jairus thinks Jesus is very rude. Peter, being probably the most comical of all the biblical characters, he basically says, "Jesus, with all due respect, are you stupid?" It's like asking, you know, we played rugby yesterday, and I know we're not supposed to mention that, but let's say you're a hooker in a scrum, and you go in there, and as you engage in the middle of that scrum, you say, "Who touched me?" That doesn't make any sense, okay? So it's the same kind of scenario. There's loads of people, and he says, who touched me? Who did that?" And for Peter, it didn't make any sense. And you know what most commentators say? They say, it's such a weird thing to put those words in, "Who touched me?" And N.T. Wright, who's one of the great New Testament historians, he says, that just reeks of an eyewitness account. because it's quite irrelevant detail who touched me, and the discussion he had with Peter after that. So it really smells like an eyewitness account, that specific thing that happened over there. Now, desperate situation number two is this woman. So the Bible uses a nice euphemism here, saying that she's had internal bleeding for 12 years, which is a euphemism for she's perpetually menstruating. So she's been menstruating for 12 years. Now, that is a horrible condition in and of itself. But in ancient Judaism, she was perpetually unclean. She was religiously and ritually unclean. So if she was married before it started, she's divorced, or probably she's never been married. She's not allowed to take part in most of the religious activities. Now, what we need to remember about these things is the fact that the medicine was really not well developed over there, so they needed to keep some sort of hygienic thing in place because they already had a very high mortality rate or a very low mortality rate? High mortality rate, I think. So they needed to put these things in place. But this girl was socially and politically sidelined. She was not only unclean, but everything she touched became unclean for a certain period of time. So if she touched a person, that means that that person is unclean for a day. So he's not allowed to partake in the temple structures or whatever. If she touched an object and somebody else touched that object, it was the same kind of scenario that happened. So can you imagine how desperate and how lonely this woman must have felt like? And she saw her chance. Because when Jesus is walking around and there's such a crowd and there's such a commotion around him, what does she do? She says, I can disappear in this crowd because everybody's freaking out about Jesus, so I can touch all of them and make everybody impure in my line of entry. And when I just get just a little bit close to him, I can touch him and I can be healed, and that's okay. But I cannot approach them from the start. I cannot walk up and say, hey Jesus, can you please heal me? Because everybody would say, oh, there's the bleeding girl. We can't do that. Keep a safe distance. So there was no way for her to do this publicly. She had to do it anonymously. Two very, very desperate situations. But then she gets called out. So Jesus turns around and he says, who touched me? Now what's interesting here is the fact that this woman was very desperate, and this woman's faith should be commended. But it was also a naive faith. It was also a very superstitious faith from this girl. Because maybe she saw Jesus as a little bit of a magician or a battery of some sort. I know there's a bunch of Star Wars freaks amongst us. Maybe they saw Jesus as a force. So if you can come close to the force, then you'll be healed, or you can manipulate the force in some sort of way. So she had a superstitious faith, there's no doubt about it, an ignorant one. But it's beautiful because Jesus still rewards that. He turns around and he says, who is this? Now obviously, it's one of those questions where God is asking in the garden, where are you guys? Where's Adam? Where's Eve? Where are you guys hiding? So it's not a question to get information. It is a question to reveal something. And then this lady comes to the fore and she reveals herself. Now it says there that she's trembling, but it's trying to stress she is shivering. She is so scared. Because she realized that she's broken every social taboo in touching him. But she also realizes that she's healed. And she goes forward and she says that I touched you. And Jesus says, your faith saved you. Well done. But what's beautiful about this thing is the fact that Jesus would not allow this girl to just touch him and use his force and then be on her way. Because that's not how it works. And this is something that a lot of people do not understand about Christianity. This is a thing that a lot of Christians do not understand about Christianity. It's the fact that that Jesus and God is not a force, it's not a power, it's not an energy, but it's a person. And if you want to be healed, whether it's emotionally or spiritually or physically or whatever, you need to know the healer. So it becomes very personal. And Jesus won't allow people to just come and get a little bit of the aura, of the energy, and not reveal. That he refuses for us to remain anonymous. And that is what's happening in this particular scenario. And then he says something quite beautiful. He says, "Daughter, your faith has saved you." Now, this is the only woman that Jesus ever referred to as daughter. "Daughter, your faith has saved you." Now, at this stage, I don't think we can even comprehend what she must have felt like. Because remember, she's been marginalized her whole life. And for the first time, she's probably had no family ties. And for the first time, here's a guy calling her daughter. It's an intimate name. It's a family name. And here's something that's also a little bit ironic. This lady was probably older than Jesus. There's no reason why she was young. She was either the same age or older. So Jesus says, "Daughter, your faith has saved you." And why does he do that? Because remember what Jesus' mission was on earth. He's bringing back everybody into this family. That is his invitation. He is bringing back the family. So by calling her daughter, he's basically saying, "Welcome back. I know you feel like you've been an outcast socially and religiously and whatever, but you're back. You are a daughter again." And this woman must have been completely overwhelmed. Now, what about poor Jairus at this stage? Because remember, here's a guy whose daughter is busy dying. They're walking, and Jesus wants to know who touched him in this stampede of a crowd, so it already seems silly. Now, I mean, we can just imagine Jairus jumping on one leg to the other leg and saying, that is the girl, she's unpure, she's healed, blah, 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 I'm great, let's go. Or these people touch you, excellent, let's do that, let's do a walk and talk, and yes, her faith saved her, okay, great. And they're going towards Jairus' house, but then as they are going there, they receive word that the girl has already passed away, that Jairus should stop bothering the teacher, should stop bothering Jesus. I mean, at this stage, it must have been very, very despairing. And imagine being Jairus at that moment, because surely it was not necessary for Jesus to stop and have this whole conversation with this girl. I mean, she could have been healed. She could have been anonymous and a healthy anonymous girl. And he could have saved her life, the daughter's life. This is very unreasonable. And Jesus says, just believe. Just have faith. Just believe. And these two stories are playing off one another. So as he's walking over there is mourners already there. Now, this is so weird about the culture back then, is they had professional mourners. I've mentioned it a couple of times, which meant that the family paid you to mourn whenever there was a funeral so that people would be sad in the area. So there were such a thing as a professional mourner. But what amazes me about this passage is how quick they are to their job. So, I mean, obviously it's a small community. They hear this girl is dead. This guy is still fetching Jesus to go and save him. And already they are at their home crying at their job very early, crying, and I don't know, they're on the clock, so to speak. So they are mourning outside Jairus' house, and Jesus comes there. And then Jesus says, "No, don't worry, she's just asleep." And then they laugh. Now, I think that is very ironic, because their job is to mourn, right? And it just says, and Jesus said, "No, she's sleeping," and they laughed. I mean, that took somebody a while, but I mean, they should not have received their full pay for that day. That's the first thing that I think is very important. But the second thing is, why is Jesus saying that she's just asleep. Why is Jesus saying in John 11, verse 11, that Lazarus is just asleep? Because what the gospel writers are trying to show us is what death looks like from God's perspective. It's sleep. What death looks like from God's perspective. Now remember, death, according to the Bible, this is important, is not separation between the soul and the body. It is a separation between us and God. That is death. Remember what happens, what did God say would happen if Adam and Eve eat from that fruit? They will surely die, okay? So what happened when they ate from that fruit? Did they die? No, but they were separated from God. So that is what death means to God. This separation between the soul and the body, that is sleeping. So we're getting a little bit of a perspective of what death looks like from God's perspective. So they go in that room. He says that she's just sleeping. And in the Markan account, there's a specific Aramaic phrase where Jesus says Talita Kum, which means little girl, wake up, which is a way that your mom would wake you up in the morning with coffee and oh, so easy or something like that. So he just says in a very affectionate way, Talita Kum, which is beautiful because he just said to this one lady, daughter, which was an affectionate title, and now he's saying again, Talita Kum. And again, what is weird is the fact that Mark didn't translate that into Greek because Talita Kum is still Aramaic. He didn't translate that into Greek. And the reason they think that that happened is because it was an eyewitness account and it made such an impact on them in the Aramaic that they decided to keep it in so that it can keep its, its Aramaic touch because those words really made an impact on the eyewitnesses who heard it. Now, what do these various stories, what does it tell us? Let's start with the woman who's suffering from internal bleeding. She has got an ignorant faith. There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about the fact that she is she's treating Jesus a little bit like a force, like an energy of some sorts. But what is amazing about it, nonetheless, is the fact that Jesus meets her where she is at. And that is something that I think we need to realize, is that you've got people who's more mature in their faith, and you've got people who's obviously less mature in their faith. But for God, there's a really an equal playing field, and he's going to just meet you where you are at. And even if you are trembling, even if you are going there for your own selfish reasons, it is as if God can use that and make it beautiful. And I've seen this over and over again. Somebody who's very close to me couldn't care less about God or church or anything. But he's socially awkward, so most of the people around him couldn't care less about him. So he doesn't make friends very easily. So now he goes to church because they have to be friends with him, because their pastor tells them, you will be friends with whomever comes across your way, because that is what God says. And a lot of Christians don't really like that, and other people try to milk that because they want friends. And this guy was one of those people. And now he's going to cell groups, and I've got no doubt he's annoying everybody wherever he goes. He's really socially awkward. But I've seen real growth in this person. I've seen some genuine growth, spiritually, emotionally, and all of these things. And when he came to God, he did not do it for pure reasons. It was very, very selfish reasons. But God can redeem that. God can use that, even if that faith is ignorant to begin with. And there's lots of examples that we can that we can use. But remember that I said in the beginning that we need to use our imagination. And if we use our imagination, it means, and this is what the Bible claims about itself, these are not just things that happened in the past, but these are things that are happening today. We are this woman. We are Jairus. And that is how we need to read the Bible. We need to put ourselves into these characters. And the fact of the matter is, and remember the story about this woman, it said that she has spent all of her money on doctors trying to fix her. She's tried loads and loads of different techniques. And I read up on some of the techniques they had in those days, medically, in order to heal somebody who had this internal bleeding problem. And it got quite bizarre. So you had to get this one drink with a bunch of onions or something inside of it, and then you would drink, and then you must say, "Arise, woman, and be gone with your flux," or something like that. And if that didn't work three times, somebody had to scare her from behind with those same words while she's drinking that. And if that doesn't work, I don't think the medical handbook has got a next chapter on what happens if that doesn't work. But she's spent a lot of money. And obviously, when she had money and she approached people with a cure, they would have been very optimistic about it and said, no, maybe we must just try this thing. Maybe I must just scare you from your left side and not from your right side. Or they were mixing it up a little bit. Now, we can laugh about it, but here's what God is telling us, is that we are this woman. And we might be physically, but definitely emotionally, we are a mess. We are internally bleeding from our hearts. It is a bit of a sewage over there. And I know this is not very politically correct to say that humans suck, but it is empirically verifiable that humans suck. And if you guys are part of humanity, then you guys are included in that suckiness. So if this is the case, then what God is saying is we should stop spending our time and our money on all of these other cures. We should stop standing in queue and get people to scare us, to get rid of this sin that's effectively living in us. We need to go to Him. And we can go to Him even if it's stupid, even if we just try to touch His clothes, even if we go to Him without having good intentions. That is okay, but just come. So this lady is not just some desperate woman in first century Palestine with a serious medical condition. It's us. It's all of us. And what about Jairus? Oh yes, he's very much us. Why do I say that? Because when we approach Jesus with our problems, let's say we reflect on this passage of the woman being healed, and we decide, God, I'm approaching you. I want this to happen. I want to get rid of what's going on here. I want help for that person. I want help for that person. When you approach God with that, and you've got that expectation, what do you want? It has to happen now. This has to happen now. And we triple on one leg, and we go to the other, a lot like Jairus. And then you think, God, what are you doing? Why are you waiting, working with this crowd? Why aren't you doing this now? And God is telling us through this story that our time and His time is not necessarily the same thing. That doesn't mean that He's not going to come through for you. But it does mean that His time and our time are not necessarily the same thing. And to me, this is very comforting. So, I want to stop with this by saying that we need to remind ourselves that we are the trembling, sick person without a family whom Jesus calls a daughter and a son. We are that woman. And we are the dad, the impatient and desperate dad. And when we are impatient like that and desperate like that, Jesus just looks at us and says, don't worry, just believe. Do not fear, just believe. And we've said a couple of times that those words, do not fear, are the most spoken command in the Bible. Do not fear. And those words are as true to us today as it were to Moses, to Jairus, to David, and to all these figures that we read about in the Bible. Not because they just were historical figures, but because this story is the story of humanity and it's the story of us. Let us pray. Lord, thank you for giving us a human book. Thank you for giving us a book that talks about us and our weaknesses. And Lord, I pray that we can really transpose ourselves into these circumstances and to really see what it was like for this woman and for Jairus, Lord, and to remind ourselves that you are as real to us today as you were to these individuals. And Lord, there's people in this room who are incredibly, incredibly desperate. And I want you, Lord, to just be very real to them today. Maybe they don't even think that you are real, Lord, but I pray that you will reveal yourself to them. And in their desperation, Lord, and we all have our various degrees of desperation, to just remind us that we just need to believe, Lord, that's all it takes. Even if it's selfish, even if the only reason that we're remotely interested in you is because we're going through a tough patch. But God, you are the God of miracles. And you are active, you're not absent. You're not a deistic God, you didn't create and now you're hiding. Help us, Lord, not just in the physical stuff, not just in the medical stuff or the financial stuff where we are desperate. But Lord, I pray that we are open about the sin in our lives and the filth that's in our hearts, and to invite you, Lord, to come in there and to clean it up. We are a desperate group of people, Lord. And being desperate is not a bad place to be, because it's almost a prerequisite for your grace to really flow and to really work. So we pray for that grace, Lord, to just penetrate us, to go inside of us and to rest in our hearts. We pray all of this in your precious name. Amen. All right. So, there's a microphone, and you guys are more than welcome to make comments or ask questions or the like. And please feel free to walk around and grab some coffee or water or anything like that. You are more than welcome.
Johan, thanks for the talk. The ruler of the synagogue, ne?
Yeah.
Is that title somewhere else in the scriptures as well? So is that just like a synonym for the head Pharisee?
No.
Or a synonym for someone's chai latte or something? Because I don't recall, you know, seeing it somewhere else.
Okay. So he was not a member of the Pharisees or the Sadducees necessarily. As president of the synagogue, he was responsible for the liturgy that would happen on a Sunday. So he'll have to invite the people who's going to pray, who's going to do the reading. I'm not sure what would be an Afrikaans equivalent of that in like the traditional church. But he's pretty much the gatekeeper of what's going on in the synagogue. And remember, in those days, there weren't really a lot of prestigious positions. So that was one of the prestigious positions, a little bit like apartheid South Africa, you know, where the guy who's got the keys of the church is a very important person. But he wasn't necessarily a Pharisee or a Sadducee, but given his position, it means that he would have been the people he would have worked with, the people he would have invited to speak in the synagogue would have been Pharisees or Sadducees. So yeah, it was more of a leadership position than a religious position specifically. Is there another question?
Hi, yes, Johan. My question is actually originally based on the fact that it was a... What's the word that the religious leader of a synagogue, that guy? Anyway, but just to ask anyway, Would it be sufficient enough for the public to influence someone of such power to actually become Christian? Like maybe sway all the Jewish people to become Christian from what happened? Because Jesus is now Christian, assumably.
Well, let me just make sure I understand the question right. Are you saying, would it be fair for that person, this Jairus,
yeah,
to become a believer in Jesus and to leave his previous religion?
That's it. And possibly even say, okay, all my fellow Jewish people, Jews no more, follow Jesus.
Okay. All right, thanks. All right, now, one thing you need to understand is that Jesus was not a Christian. He was Jesus. Okay? He was a Christ. So he couldn't have really been a Christian. So it doesn't really make sense. I suppose you are a Johannin if I really believe in myself and that I'm going to get through this sermon or whatever. But Jesus was a Jew. Okay? And this is something that we need to realize. What I'm trying to do when I'm preparing for a sermon is I'm trying to explain to you the Jewish customs in a lot of these things. Because we will not understand Jesus if we do not understand Judaism. So Jesus did not think of himself as doing something different from Judaism. He's saying, I came to fulfill these things. But he considers himself God's vehicle, and the climax of that vehicle of God coming back to his Israelites. So he is profoundly Jewish, and he is fulfilling all the work that has been done. Unfortunately, what happened is not all the Jews responded to that call. Now remember, the first church was almost exclusively Jewish. The disciples, these guys were Jewish. Remember when Paul is going around in the synagogues, they allow him in the synagogues. Now, they will never allow a pagan in the synagogues. They wouldn't allow a Zeusian or a Dionysian or anybody to come and preach there. But they allow Paul and these guys because they were still under the impression that these guys are Jewish. And then somewhere along the line, they said, uh-uh, you guys are not Jewish. We're not happy with this Jesus preaching. And they cut them off. And then it became a different religion, if you will. But if you're a Christian, you'll notice that there's a big fat part of this book on this side, which is the Old Testament. So we very much believe in those things. We just believe that Jesus was the fulfillment of all those things. So for Jairus to be a committed and devoted Jew, I think he should have understood the climax and the fulfillment of Judaism in Jesus. And that's why there's a big movement about Jews for Jesus, who still hold to their cultural identity as Jewish people, but they see Jesus as the fulfillment of that whole expectation. I hope that makes a little bit of sense.
Thanks, Jan. In Numbers 15, God commands Moses to ask the people to make garments, Numbers 15, verses 37 to 41, with tassels on them. The tassels are called talit. In Malachi 4 and verse 2, it says, the Son of Righteousness has risen on you with healing in his wings. And that is what the woman touched, the tassels. So the healing of the woman was a fulfillment of that Malachi prophecy. Secondly, whatever she touched became unclean. When Jesus went to the dead girl's place, if he went in there, he would have been unclean. But wherever Jesus goes, whatever touches Jesus becomes clean. And wherever he goes, it becomes clean. Well, I'm not even sure I'm saying that right. But yeah, he actually changes that ceremonial law.
Although, in terms of the first thing you said, I didn't pick that up. So it seems very interesting. I wanna check into it. But no, I didn't see that. So thanks for that insight. In terms of Jesus becoming impure, and unclean. I think he does. I think he does become unclean. That is the gospel message. Jesus becomes unclean so that we become clean. That is the crux of the gospel message. And you know what is beautiful? And it's a little bit weird. It's a little bit, you know, mysterious. But Jesus said, somebody touched me because I felt power coming out of me. Now that sounds weird. It sounds a little bit like Jesus is treating himself like a Duracell. Or, you know, I don't know. It is a bit bizarre. But what a lot of the commentators say about this is that Jesus did not heal people without a cost to himself. Now that's something that we don't necessarily recognize. So we maybe just think that he's got this endless amount of power and he's walking down the street like a Donald Trump with that Apprentice song, money, 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 going in the background, and he's just throwing cash left, right, and center, and it doesn't really matter because he's got billions of dollars back there. I think what this passage is trying to illustrate is that when Jesus healed, it was at some sort of cost to himself. And that is the gospel message, and that's what makes it so beautiful. Yes, he became filthy. He became... What does Isaiah 53 say? He was ridiculed and he was made disgusting for our inadequacies. So that is the gospel message right there. He takes the dirt, we become clean. Yeah.
Was Jesus fully God, or was he a man and healed in the name of the Father? And this question is leading up to, can we do the same thing today, despite people who believe in cessation of miracles?
Just repeat the first bit. Was Jesus
fully God, or was he man relying on the Father? Was he a model for Christians today in the 21st century? I understand that we're all incredibly well-educated with many letters behind our name.
All right, well, I hope you guys didn't have plans for tomorrow, because this is probably one of the biggest theological questions. As a matter of fact, churches have split because of this thing. And this is a problem because we're already small tonight. So let's see what happens, and please feel free to add to this. I am not... I think my opinion changes with respect to this as I read and hear different opinions. I think the confession tells us that Jesus was 100% God and 100% man. Now, I know that just sounds like a rhetorical trick. He didn't say anything. But where I'm at now, I think that he was so convinced, he was fully human. He was not this battery walking around here, this super... He wasn't Superman who could fly and have these powers. He was just so well connected with his other that he was able to do those things in faith. So he was able to call on it in faith. So that is one position. And it's not necessarily the dominant position. So I think that is something that I'm sympathetic towards. In terms of whether these things can still happen today, yes. I haven't seen it. I've gone to a couple of services before, to these healing services, and to some of them I went there, I don't know, because I was bored and I wanted to be entertained, and I didn't really... go there with honesty in my heart, and I left there with a smirk on my face, not really thinking anything about it. Other times I've went there genuinely, and I still wasn't convinced about the healing power in these healing services. And if you drive around, especially in the inner city, you'll see a lot of these advertisements about these big rallies that they're going to have. So from my personal experience, I haven't really experienced anything from those events that I attended. Theologically, there's no reason I can say that has stopped. So there's a branch of Christians, they call cessationalists, which is actually weird because these guys, it sounds like sensational, but they're really not sensational. They're quite boring. So cessationalist says that dispensation of the miracles stopped. So when Jesus came, it was this massive thing. The supernatural world was going crazy, and I think it's true, and then it stopped. Now, I'm not sure it stopped, full stop. I think it got less, but I don't think it stopped. And there's a lot of reliable friends that I have that's on the mission field, and they share wonderful stories about healing. And I can, that's why if you ask me in my personal capacity, Arnold, whether I've been healed with people laying down hands on me, I can't say that I have. I've spoken to numerous people who's claimed it, and these people aren't naive. They aren't silly. There's people over here who's got wonderful testimonies about those things. So no, I don't think it stopped. And I think we've got a command from God to, when we pray, to expect something, to have that same amount of faith. Now here's the problem though, is that a lot of people would look at that passage and say, I've used this example a couple of times, the girl who really wanted to be on the house committee of her hostel. So if you go to Porch, it's a big thing to be on the haka of your kosais. And she prayed for it, and she read the passages, if you ask for this, God will give it to you, and then she was not on the haka. And now obviously, you know, God does not exist, because she sincerely asked for it. Now again, I think she's treating God a little bit like a force, like an energy that you manipulate. You say nice things to him, you call him, he helps you over here, and everything is good. And I think sometimes God does that. He meets us with that stupid faith. That does happen. But what this passage is all about is that God is primarily interested in the person. We should not just be interested in the healing, but in the healer. And that is a very fine balance that we need to run on. And being a Christian is a massive contradiction, guys, because there are incredible miracles. When I went to Oxford, and they get all these brilliant people from around the world who share their stories, going into the Middle East with Bibles, and I've heard stories about what's happening at their refugee camps in Syria. I met a guy who Christine introduced me to, who's working in those Syrian refugee camps. We're talking about, it makes the Bible look like a PG-13 book. We're talking about hardcore stuff. And a lot of those people, I believe. But then, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of Christians who pray and who do not receive immediate answer to their prayers. And that's probably the contradiction as Christians that we need to deal with. That's my opinion. Derek, do you want to add to that?
The only thing I could say is a good book on this is The Mystery of God, that has got a whole chapter on that thing of God, man, or God. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's just a book I can recommend. Other than that, I don't have anything to add. It's just interesting in terms of how the account was written. If you look at the book of Mark, it says, and the lady suffered under many physicians. Although if you look at Luke, there's a footnote which says many of the manuscripts omit that she went to many physicians for healing. And that's just because Luke was a physician. So he just wanted to say she suffered from this, but... It wasn't
our profession's fault. Yeah,
it's not our profession's fault.
He was covering up for the doctors.
So, and that's just some sort of interesting account from how it was written from a human point of view.
Yeah, but that's beautiful, and it shows you, it illustrates the human element in it all. I can really tell you that sometimes when you're busy with the Bible, you think, oh, it's a wonderful story and it's really exciting. But when I studied this passage, I was really reminded about the fact that these things are embedded in history. There's a lot of these stuff that's just really eyewitness accounts. And it was fun for me to be reminded, and it might sound scary to you guys that I need to be reminded that this was really history. But I was reminded of that again this week. Yes, James.
I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Lucy. What I got from that is that we have the capacity to be something more. And talking about Jesus, I firmly believe that he was a superhuman being. There's just no other way to look at it. A normal human being is not capable of doing that on his own or her own. I think it's cool that Jesus was this superhuman being, but had all the human attributes necessary to connect with us.
Listen, I mean, my studies are about the correlation between Superman and Jesus. So there's no doubt that I'm going to agree with you that Jesus was a superhuman being. There's no doubt that I would look at all the major superheroes that we pay hundreds of rands to go and watch on the big screen because they share similarities with Jesus. I've got no doubt about it. But I think I am interested about the fact that Jesus emptied himself, as Philippians says, of all his divineness when he was here. But because of the community he has with the Father, it meant that there was a weird kind of balance. And again, this is one of the contradictions of being a Christian. So if you're not a Christian, this is a good reason not to be a Christian, I suppose, because there's contradictions. But one of these contradictions are to keep this balance between he was really human, but he emptied himself, and he still had access to God the Father. And in faith, I think, he performed a lot of those miracles.
If I can just add, I think that to what James is saying, I think that the gifts that Jesus had, I mean, he only really started practicing after he'd been in the desert. So he came out with this new power that to do miracles. And I think in a similar way, before we can get to a point where we also operate in miracles, we have to sort of go through an orientation or training period so that you don't have these sort of immature Christians throwing around miracles and using it in a superstitious way, like you said. I think that's what distinguishes it, is that it has to be done in maturity and in connection with all the principles that are in the Bible. So, but I think that there's enough scripture to give evidence that the superpowers that Jesus had are for us as well. Just to respond to you, Arnold, what you were saying, the gifts of the Spirit, which would be, I mean, the healing is one of them, the gift of healing, but there's a word of knowledge, gift of prophecy, gift of mercy. I mean, he puts those in one category together, speaking in tongues, interpreting, whatever. So I think we can ask for those gifts and we can operate in them. I think that then God, it is spiritual and God works through us. And just to also say, you were talking about a superstitious faith, and I think that woman did have, she was superstitious, but as soon as you put that superstition in Jesus, you focus it on, it becomes faith and it actually is real. So it's no longer superstitious, it's the power of God. So I think that's what makes the gifts legitimate, is because you are doing it in walking with Jesus in your Christian faith. So there's a responsibility, you know, you have to go through the desert before you can actually operate in them. It's not just superstition, you know, shouting and giving people frights and whatever. It's God on the other side, you know.
Cool. Let's disagree. Arman, and then Anami. And then time.
Johan, you've mentioned the contradictions in the Christian faith a couple of times tonight. I think I'd rather call them paradoxes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you'd agree with me.
Yeah, yeah, but, bad English, sorry.
On something which does feel to me to be a slight contradiction, you and I as well like repeating this thing about it's not the size of your faith, but it's who you have faith in that makes the difference, right? But it seems to me, and it might not come out so strongly in this passage, that sometimes Jesus is amazed at the size of someone's faith, or the size of someone's faith does seem to have some role in the efficacy of whatever's happening. So could you maybe comment on that?
I think when he says that I haven't seen that much faith in all of Israel, because that's most of the times where we hear about it. I think why he's amazed is because these guys were not supposed to have faith in the first place. It was the Israelites, the Jews, who should have responded in this way. And he expected that more from the Jewish people and not necessarily from the Gentiles. What I find interesting, though, is that he says a similar thing about the guy when he's going down the mountain, the mountain where the transfiguration happened, and he's walking down. Then they are trying to, exercise a demon over there. And then there's this one guy who says, they can't do it. And then he asks him, "Do you believe?" And he says, "I do believe, but help me in my unbelief. Help me where I'm not believing." And again, Jesus was quite impressed with this guy, even though he wasn't, he admitted to the fact that he didn't have a lot of faith. But afterwards, the disciples asked him in that specific scenario, "Why couldn't we exorcise that demon?" And they said, some demons just need to be exorcised through prayer. Now, he's mocking them a little bit because they were getting arrogant about their own capabilities. They were seeing that this Jesus thing works, so let me start a Peterism or a Jamesism or whatever and exorcise these demons. And he says, yeah, most of the time, some demons, you really need to pray. And I think what he's trying to say is you need to pray to Jesus. And that's what a lot of commentators would say about that passage. You need to pray. In other words, you cannot do that on your own. It is because of me that you are able to do that. And when that other guy said, "I do believe, help me in my unbelief," he didn't have a lot of it, but he knew the only chance he had for his little boy was this guy. And that's why Jesus rewarded that in that sense. I do think, however, that there's certain big steps in faith. The only problem that we have with those things, and this is why people like myself and you are a little bit embarrassed when we see instances of where there's a lot of faith and Jesus is impressed with a lot of faith, is because the fundamental thing about Christianity is that we are not great. We don't really do amazing stuff. The primary story of the gospel is God did it, and we respond to that. But there is obviously a balance. There is something that we need to get to the table. We're not going to get off that easily. And that is the paradox, maybe not the contradiction. Sorry, I used contradiction incorrectly. But that is the paradox. Yes, it is about Jesus, the object of our faith. But yes, we need to take a leap as well, even if it's just a small one.